My thoughts for this morning were prompted by that passage from 2 Kings that Ryan read. We studied in the children's class not too long ago. I found this passage very interesting for a number of reasons. It describes the beginning of the history of the reign of King Hezekiah. The scriptures say he was the greatest of the kings of Judah. He led a great revival in obedience and worship of God. And if you want more about that, you can go to 2 Chronicles chapters 29 and 31. It describes it in very, very explicit detail in three chapters, whereas here we only have just a couple of verses. In 2 Chronicles 31, it says, "And thus did Hezekiah throughout all Judah, and wrought that which was good and right and truth before the Lord his God. And every work that he began in the service of the house of God, and in the law, and in the commandments to seek his God, he did it with all his heart and prospered." So Hezekiah was a very good king, and he did it because he trusted in the Lord. What made him so great was his complete trust and his obedience to God. In verse 6 it says, "For he clave to the Lord. He grabbed a hold of God, held fast to him, and he didn't let him go. He never loosened his grip on the Lord." That's a very great mental image to me about holding on to God. To grab a hold of God and hold him tight. Your knuckles are white. To never let him go. To get more than this far away from you. That's how close God always is to you. That's how close he was to Hezekiah. It's a comforting thought, and we should all aspire to have that sort of devotion to God, to be that close to him. But that's not what caught my interest, really. I was thinking more about the symbolism of the story. The symbolism of that was very important to me. It really touched me, holding fast to God. But it was another bit of symbolism, another piece of history that really caught my attention. And me being the history guy, you probably picked up on it. It's a piece of history that King Hezekiah referred to as Nehushtan, a brazen or a bronze serpent on a pole that the Israelites were burning incense to at this time. This was an ancient piece of history to the Israelites, one of the few remaining items that they brought with them into the promised land out of the wilderness. And that's what I want to talk about this morning. And to find the origin of that, we have to go back more than 700 years, depending on which Bibles you read, 700 to 1,000 years before is when you find this brazen serpent pole. You go back to the time of the Israelites wandering in the wilderness. They're trying to get to the promised land, and they come to the land of Edom, and they want to pass through the land of Edom. But the Edomites won't let them. They oppose them in force, and they say, "You can't pass." And that little piece of history you'll find as the conflict between the Edomites and the Israelites for the rest of history. That incident colored their relationships, and they were enemies forever because of that. So they couldn't go through the land of Edom, and they had to go around. So they were forced to go into the south through a long, hard march in a very barren land. So let's look at Numbers chapters 21, starting in verse 4. "And they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom. And the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. And the people spake against God and against Moses, 'Wherefore have you brought us up out of the land of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, neither is there any water. And our soul loatheth this light bread, the manna that from God was given them to sustain them.' They said they hated it. And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people. They bit the people, and much people of Israel died. Therefore the people came to Moses and said, 'We have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray unto the Lord that he take away the serpents from us.' And Moses prayed for the people." Moses loved his people. He prayed for them. "The Lord said to Moses, 'Make thee a fiery serpent and set it upon a pole. And it shall come to pass that everyone that is bitten, when he looketh upon it, shall live.' And Moses made a serpent of brass and put it on a pole, and it came to pass that if a certain had bitten any man, when he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived." So we have this account of how the bronze serpent was made. The Israelites are in the wilderness. They're tired of eating the same bread. They're thirsty, and they're hungry, and they're tired. If you remember right before this, we have the story of Moses and Aaron at the what they call Meribah, the well of Meribah, where they're asking for water. And Moses says, "Do I have to bring water out of this rock for you?" Because of that, because he took the credit for that miracle of God, he and Aaron were not allowed to go into the promised land. So that happened just prior to this. So the Israelites are not happy. They're thirsty. What happened? They lose their faith. They do it over and over again. They lose their faith in Moses, and they lose their faith in God. They lose their trust in God. They begin to question him and question why he led them into the wilderness. They relaxed their grip on God. They let him go. They let him get away from him. They no longer hold him tight, and they sin. And as a consequence of that sin, God sends these fiery serpents to plague them. The people complain to Moses, "We know we've sinned. We've let God go. Take away these serpents from us. Take them away." What's God's response? Does he take away the serpents? No, he doesn't, because you cannot take away the consequences of sin. Once you sin, you live with the consequences. Galatians 6:7, "Be not deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man soweth, that shall he also reap." When you sin, you live with the consequences. God won't undo the result of your sin, but what will he do? He provides a way out for you. He provides a comfort for you. So what did he do for the Israelites? He commands Moses to make the serpent pole and tells them how to use it. If you're bitten by the serpent, look upon the pole and you'll live. You still have to go through all the consequences of that. The pain, whatever it takes, swelling, redness, sickness, anything that happens because of being bitten by that serpent, you still have to endure it because that's the consequence of your sin. But you won't die. Look on the pole and you won't die. So does that pole have any miraculous powers? Did God make this be a miracle to the people that they will not die if they look on this pole? The answer is, of course, like all the questions I ask up here, yes and no. It's always yes and no. So if I ask a question, it's yes and no. Remember that answer. So why did he make this? I mean, what is this pole? Why did he make a pole for him? Why didn't he just say, "Pray to me and you won't die"? Why did he do this? What is this image? Why didn't he make it a pillar of fire? That seems to be his image as they're wandering through the wilderness. That was God, a pillar of fire. Or an angel, a cherubim. Why didn't he make it one of those things? Because he wanted it to be a symbol of their sin. He wanted them to remind them of their sin. How did Satan first appear to Adam and Eve in the garden? It was a serpent. What did he send to afflict them? Serpents. He would remind them, "This is your sin. It's not going to go away. I will save you from it, but it's not going to go away." So the serpents and the serpent pole is a symbol of their sin. But at the same time, it's a reminder. It's a reminder of the grace and the love and the mercy of God. It's a reminder of who can save them. Who can save them? Only God can save you. Look on the pole. It is your sin, but I will save you from it. It restores and strengthens their faith in God. It renews their trust in him. It demonstrates their obedience. God told Moses to build it. He built it. He tells the people to look at it. They look at it. They live. By looking at the bronze serpent, they stretch out their hand and they grab a hold of God again. They pull him back close. He's no longer away from them. They cleave back to him and hold him fast. So the love of God for his people, the faith of an obedient servant, is what saves them. That's the miracle. The pole has no miracle. It's their faith in the operation of God that he will save them. That's the miracle. So, more than 700 years later, they still have this bronze serpent pole. The King James Version says that King Hezekiah called it Nehushtan. And some of the commentators speculate that this is derived from a word that means brass or a piece of brass. And that Hezekiah is disparaging when we refer it to just a piece of brass. It has no meaning. It's nothing. It's just a piece of brass. Other translators say that other translations of the scriptures say that they or the people call it Nehushtan. So other commentators say that it was a name of reverence. It comes from a closely related word that means, oddly enough, serpent. And that the people were calling it the serpent or the great serpent. It was an object of reverence for them. Either way, the people did revere it. They burnt incense to it in worship. And why wouldn't they place special value on it? It was made by Moses, a great hero and patriarch of the people. It was made at God's direct command. It was a sacred relic of their past that they had brought with them. All those years ago, it was there. So why wouldn't they revere it? But Hezekiah goes and he destroys it. So when, I think it was Mark was teaching the children's class up here, he said, "Was that wrong? This thing was made by God, made by Moses. Was it wrong to destroy it?" No. It was originally made for a specific purpose, a holy purpose, to save the people, to lead them away from sin and back to God, to restore their faith. Now it served a different purpose, an unholy purpose. It served to lead the people away from God, out of his grasp, and into idolatry. It had become an idol. It was made as a symbol of their sin and to be a reminder of the true object of their worship, which is God. But it had taken the place of God and become the object of their worship. They worshipped the pole and not the Creator. It had become as God to them. I can see it must have pleased Satan so much to see people worshiping this serpent, this symbol that he had used to deceive God's children in the very beginning. So this story has a very clear message for us. I mean, that's why it's here. It's a warning. It's a warning to us. We must be careful not to let ourselves be deceived and distracted from the true object of our worship and start worshiping those things that are not God. Those things that were created for a holy purpose but have been corrupted by man into something else. I came up with a few ideas here. You may agree or disagree. Of course, music is one of them. Music was created for a holy purpose, that we should revere God, that we should glorify Him. But now the music itself becomes the focus of our attention. Its creation, its presentation, its form and function and content. The music becomes holy rather than the person that is meant to glorify. We have dynamic leaders out there in the world, passionate, talented speakers, and evangelists that are elevated above their proper place. The people become greater than the message. They're supposed to deliver this message, but they're delivering themselves. People go to men for healing or for inspiration or for strength. Instead, they need to go to God, not to these leaders. They need to go to God. Of course, I have to rail against televangelists because they're just so interesting. It's late at night, going through the channels, you come across these shows, and they're just, I can't help but watch, because they're just so interesting. And one televangelist, Mr. Happy, I call him, he's got a huge globe that rotates behind him, and it's like the whole world is at his command. And his message is, be the best you can be, which is a good message, but you hardly ever hear about God in there anywhere. It's not, be the best you can be for you, instead of being the best you can be for God. Another one I've seen recently, it's like a talk show format, and they're talking back and forth. And what I notice is they're sitting in these chairs that are huge, high-back chairs. They're ornate, they're satin, they're gilded in gold, they're thrones. They're sitting on these thrones. That's why I said there's two people sitting on thrones talking about God. They're trying to build a palace on earth and a throne for themselves on earth instead of waiting until they get to heaven where their real reward would be. It's almost as if they're afraid they're not going to get there. Other things that we put above God are buildings. They become places of entertainment or of socialization rather than gathering place for the faithful. They become ornamental and luxurious rather than functional. They become the objects of worship rather than houses of worship. Nathan and I are in Scouts. We have a big church that is the sponsor of our troop. It's a huge church in West Des Moines. But it's only really a medium-sized church compared to some of the other huge churches that are there. I was wandering around there the other day, and they've got two auditoriums. The smallest is a lot bigger than this, and the big one is huge. In the basement, they've got a room set up. It looks like a teen room, and there's a stage and a band over in one corner, and there's a snack bar and a kitchen over in the other corner, and it's interesting. It's like it brings the people in. The people are very involved. But does it build a solid foundation for their faith? That's the question. Does it build a solid foundation for their faith that when they suffer persecution in the world, is that a place they've built their faith strong enough that it's going to withstand that? Or is it just because it's fun to be there and it's a fun environment? And when it's not fun anymore, then do they fall? And that's just one of the smaller, the medium-sized churches. There are bigger than that. In the world, there are huge churches out there that become objects of worship. We're talking about in the class downstairs, we're talking about the Roman Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire in Constantinople. There's a huge church in Constantinople. Well, there was, called Hagia Sophia. It's nicknamed the mother of all churches. It was built by Justinian in 537, and for almost 1,000 years, it was built upon and elaborated and became this huge church till the Muslims conquered Constantinople in 1453. And the very first thing they did was they went into that church and they converted it to a mosque. The very first thing. And of course, the Christian world was outraged at this. How could they do this? This sacred place they've changed, you know, made it an unholy place. Is it a sacred place? Is it unholy now? It's a building. It's not the structure, it's the people. And just for information, in 1935, the Turkish government changed it from mosque into a museum now. So now the Muslims are mad too. So you can go there to this day. And I love to go there. It's a huge, beautiful place, but not for inspiration from God, but because it's historically significant. As I was writing this, I realized that I actually have seen that place, but I was floating by on a warship at the time, and it was way off in the distance. So I didn't get a very good look at it, but there were two huge mosque-looking buildings off in the distance, and they were beautiful. I don't know which one it was, but it's not a house of God unless we're there. So these things that I mentioned are built or made for a specific purpose, to glorify God. Just as the serpent pole was made for a specific purpose. God gives us the ability to make music to express our love and our desire for Him. God gives dynamic leaders talent so that they can help more effectively spread the word of God and help us delve into it so that we can find inspiration from God, not from them. And God blesses us with material resources to have these buildings, to build them so that we can come and worship Him, have a stable and a safe place to do that. But if we're not careful, their intent and their use can be twisted so that they become above God. They take the place of the person they were intended to glorify. So we can find one more reference in the scriptures to Nehushtan. And I was kind of surprised to find it. But we have to go to the New Testament to do that. The reference is by our Savior himself, and as all things that he says, it's important. So we're all familiar with those famous words in John 3:16. Just back up a couple of verses and you'll find this bronze serpent pole. Let's look in John 3, starting in verse 12. If I have told you earthly things, Jesus is speaking, if I have told you earthly things and ye believe not, how shall ye believe if I tell you of heavenly things? And no man hath ascended up to heaven, but he that came down from heaven, even the Son of Man, which is in heaven. And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have eternal life. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. The bronze serpent pole was lifted up. The bronze serpent was lifted up on a tall pole high above the whole camp for the Israelites to see. So if they were bitten, they could look upon that. Whoever was suffering the consequences of their sin could look upon that and they would be saved. They would not die. It was a reminder of their sin and who could save them. So their faith, coupled with their obedience to God's commands to look on the pole, would save them. So now we have Jesus. He's lifted up high on a cross, on a hill above Jerusalem, for all to see. We as Christians today still do that. We lift him up high so all the world can see him. That's what we're supposed to do. Whoever looks on him and believes in him will not die, but will live. Our faith, coupled with our obedience, will save us. But Satan has taken even this great event, even this great thing, and he's corrupted it. We have a symbol that was meant to be an aid for us, and now it has become the focus of our attention. And I say ours, not necessarily ours, but the world's. And of course, I'm talking about the cross. Jesus died on the cross. He's the one that deserves our worship. But it seems in today's society that the cross is what receives our attention. The cross has become a symbol of worship and not Jesus. Just as the Israelites began worshiping the serpent pole, the cross has become a symbol of worship. People kneeling before the cross, lighting burning incense to the cross. You see it in churches. In the religious world, bending the knee to it, the cross has become an idol. Some cases, very clearly, it seems to me. In other cases, not quite so clearly. Perhaps much more subtly. I mean, some people wear a cross on a chain. If you do, it's a piece of ornamental jewelry, like a circle on a chain or a parallelogram on a chain, I think that's fine. But if you wear it because it's a remembrance of Jesus, Why? Why do you need that cross to remember Jesus? I have something here. You can have this. Nathan and I are scouts. They make little pouches you hang around your neck to hold stuff in. Go talk to him. He'll make you a pouch, and you can have this around your neck. This is where you remember Jesus. Is this not fashionable enough for you? Does it not go with your outfit? Well, you're wearing the wrong clothes then. It doesn't go with your outfit. You might say, it's an outward sign. It's a demonstration of my faith. I wear this so I demonstrate my faith. It's not what God told you to do to demonstrate your faith. He told you to live your life so when people look at you, that's a demonstration of your faith. If the only reason they can tell you're a Christian is because you wear a cross, you got a problem. You need to look at it. And if they don't need to see that cross to know you're a Christian, then you don't need to wear it. The cross does not represent Jesus. It does represent a suffering. If you look in the Bible, it talks about the cross of Christ, the suffering of Christ. He tells you to take your cross and follow him. Pick up your suffering and your sacrifice and still follow him, and he will lead you to heaven. If you want to be reminded of the suffering and sacrifice of Jesus, then just go out into the world and live your life as a Christian. Suffering will find you. Satan will make sure of that. And sacrifice will find you as well. God will give you that opportunity. That way you can show the symbol of your faith. So, I ask the question. What are your idols? Do you have a bronze serpent pole lurking somewhere in your life? Idols take many forms. The one I've talked about this morning is one particular kind, something that was created for one purpose and now has taken on another. Created to be a worship of God and now has become God. There are others that take the place of or are put ahead of God. They aren't take the place of God, but they're in front of him. They supplant him as the thing in your life that's number one. So if these things look familiar to you, there are some things you can do. And that's what the lesson was for. What did King Hezekiah do? He broke down the high places, cut down the groves, threw the idols out. He burned the very thing that was sacred to these people, that represented God to them, and he destroyed it because it was leading them away from God. You have to trust in the Lord again. Cleave to him. Hold tight. Pull him back to you so you have your hand on him and not on something else. Don't let him get far away from you. The opportunity is yours as we stand and sing.